Great. Thank you, everybody. Sorry we're starting just a few minutes late, but it's raining here in Denver. So that's the reason why we're starting just a few minutes late. Not because I was late. First item on the agenda is our public comment time period. Is there anybody here who would like to come and speak for that three-minute time period? Seeing none, we'll go ahead and go on to our final approval of the independent needs assessment. And so I didn't hear, was Mr. Kraft on the line?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Yes.
Yeah. Great. You know, I don't know, Mr. Kraft, but if you wanted to start after, get us started with the final report that you have after the two calls that we had. Mr. Kraft, are you on?
Yes.
So would you like to go ahead and present the report or go through
the report that you have? Sure. The report that you have before you is based on the changes from your July the 11th meeting last week. And pretty much we appreciate the opportunity to work with y'all. I hope this meets your approval. And I hope it's of value to the state of Colorado. And I really don't know what else to say at this point.
So I guess I would ask any of the commissioners if you had an opportunity to look at some of the recommended changes that we had over on the phone calls. I wasn't on either of the two calls. So I don't know if anybody, if it's helpful that we go through the pages that we had in question or go through it all. Does anyone have any, what's going to suit their needs the best and kind of put that out there and then we could see if that works for everybody? Anybody have any?
Yeah, I was going to say I was current through and, the last meeting, if we could just go over what changed from the call.
Changes, and they were sent out to track changes. And I didn't
Suzanne,
have any,
just one minute.
Yeah.
We're having a little bit of heart. Your voice is really, really soft.
I had a chance to look over the report, and I looked at it in both its final form and the track changes, and I didn't have a problem with any of the changes that were included. I thought the attachments were excellent, very explanatory of some of the more specifics in the report, and I thought the report was fairly comprehensive, and I, having looked it over, I'm fine with its approval.
Great. Thank you, Suzanne. There was a one of the commissioners here wanted to see if we could go through just some of the changes, Mr. Kraft, that were made from the last meeting to this final report. Just point that out, and we can go through that if that's acceptable to the other commission members. Seem good? That makes sense to the people who are present here that work for people on the phone? I guess so, Mr. Kraft.
Okay. All right. So at the bottom of page two, if you're looking at the track changes mode document, you will see that this paragraph, which we had quite a bit of discussion over two or three meetings, we have changed the language of that to speak more specifically to the risk and kind of get county size out of it. So basically it now reads that the highest technical risk for the 2013 election is the failure to properly identify and provide the support needed by those counties with limited IT resources. And then continuing on page three, someone asked the question, why were these changes complex? And we inserted a description of the complexities. basically saying that the proposed changes include replacing the existing Citrix user faces with a new secured web application. It is also likely the data schema and queries will require modification. Changes as magnitude are accurately described as complex. In software engineering, changes like these are just short of guaranteeing to introduce errors or unintended consequences, even in the best of development environments. As a consequence, part of the task will be a need for careful inspection and testing with an expectation that further changes or adaptations will need to be made. The impact of this risk cannot be predicted at the current conceptual design level, but the risk itself is real. The connectivity issue referenced later in this report adds to this risk.
Anybody have any questions or comments on that? Okay. Go ahead and continue, Mr. Kraft.
Okay. At the top of page 4, we discussed the final need involves mitigating the biggest risk of 214 election. It requires taking steps to ensure that score connectivity, throughput, and processing capability are all adequate. We added, basically, in order to mitigate this risk, it is essential to develop an accurate estimate of these needs. And let's see. Then we skip to next to last paragraph on page 8. And we inserted the language, a high-level view diagram of the business process. Okay, and then on page 11, the bottom of the second paragraph, we added the sentence, steps must be taken to ensure that such procedures and adequate resources are in place. And the next paragraph, we added a sentence to the bottom of it saying SCORE is capable of handling this process on a daily basis, but steps must be taken to ensure that vital records and corrections provide daily updates during the 15 days prior to and on election day.
So I have a question there. This is Rick. How did we decide on 15?
15 is what was actually in the legislative fiscal note, which a number of the commissioners felt very strongly was important.
And Rick, I think that the reason it's that way is that tracks with the time. Sorry, this is Elena. The 15-day time period also tracks for a general election when the voter service and polling centers are open, so I think that was probably also why it's that way in the fiscal note.
Right. I originally thought we were trying to make up account for a 29-day gap, but it's only the last 15 that's critical.
The 29-day gap was based on, you know, doing it every 30 days, I think.
Okay. Thank you.
And that was all the changes.
Thank you. So any commissioners have any other specific questions on the final report? Looks like, Elena has a comment.
So on page 10 of the report, the section that talks about the accessibility and ADA compliance, I had offered language that I think this is just the language that I had suggested. And I don't know that it's entirely accurate when we get to the part about the funding recommendations of the Secretary of State. That's true. The Secretary of State has the ultimate authority to make those grants, so it might be helpful to amend that sentence just to make clear that the Secretary of State makes that determination.
Okay, let's see. On page 10. Oh, okay, the last paragraph.
I just think it would be more clear if we just added who makes the final determination or something that indicates that
okay.
It's the Secretary.
Have you got a specific change to put in here?
If we just added at the end of the line that says, which makes funding recommendations to the Secretary of State, a clause that says something like, who makes the final determination or award of grants? I'm sorry, there's a comment from the audience. Faith Gross has more to clarify. I'm sorry. Faith, could you come up and explain your edit?
Faith Gross. I want to be clear, the grant application goes to the Secretary of State's office. Then they share it with the Accessibility Task Force. So it's the application doesn't come directly to the task force. It comes to the SOS. And then they, at their discretion, share it with the task force, and we make recommendations. So I think it'd just be cleaner to say it goes to the Secretary of State, who shares with the Accessibility Task Force for recommendations, but the Secretary ultimately makes the decision.
And Mr. Kraft, did you get that? So there's two pieces to insert, that the application, although it goes to the Accessibility Task Force, it's not, they do not receive the applications. They go to the Secretary of State's office first, who then shares ones that they choose to with the task force, who then makes recommendations back to the Secretary of State.
Okay, so it's available by applying to the CDOS, and we're going to insert who forwards it to the Accessibility Task Force.
Right, which makes funding recommendations to the Secretary of State, who makes the determination of awards.
Okay, so simply inserting who forwards it to the solves it.
Yes. And then at the end, okay, to be super clear, we could also make clear that it's the Secretary who makes the determination, not the task force. They just make recommendations to the Secretary.
Okay, which makes funding recommendations to the Secretary of State, who issues or who awards a grant.
Correct.
Thank you.
Who awards? Or who awards and issues. Okay, so I'm going to read the sentence over again. For sites that require modification to be accessible, Federal Help America Vote Act accessibility grant funds are available by applying to the CDOS, who forwards it to the Accessibility Task Force, which makes funding recommendations to the Secretary of State, who awards and issues the grants. And I think that language would infer that you file your application with the Department of State, and it's the Secretary of State's decision.
Yep, that works. Thank you.
Okay, that changes in the document.
Just to catch everybody up on it, what we're, any last comments? We've kind of went through what the changes were, and so if there's any specific changes that anyone else has or questions, that's what the time that we have right now. Martha.
Thank you. I have a concern on page 8. In the second to last paragraph, the last sentence, after the presentation to the Commission on July 8th of several of the Act's conflicts and ambiguities, CDOS staff noted that many of the bill's conflicts can only be fixed by the legislature. I'm concerned that that appears more as fact than opinion, because I think there's a difference of opinion. So I wonder if we could say it is the opinion of CDOS staff that many of the bill's conflicts can only be fixed by the legislature, or something like that.
Does anyone have any opposition to that?
This is Richard Westfall. I could not hear what Martha was saying, so if you could sort of redirect me to, or if you could, someone could restate what her question or concern was, I'd appreciate it. I just couldn't hear it.
Okay, Richard, I'll try again. It's on page 8, the second to last paragraph, the last sentence. It says
page 8. Okay.
So my suggestion is that we change, that the staff noted that many of the bill's conflicts can only be fixed by the legislature, that it is the opinion of the CDOS staff or something like that, that many of the bill's conflicts can only be fixed by the legislature.
So were you able to get that, Richard?
So please, right now, after the presentation of several of the acts, conflicts, and ambiguities, CDOS staff noted, and then you just wanted to say that CDOS staff noted, you say it is the opinion of CDOS staff. Is that what you wanted to say?
Yes.
Okay. So is there any objections to that? Okay, so...
This is Suzanne. It just seems redundant. If CDOS staff noted it, then wasn't it our opinion?
So, Suzanne, would you be objected to put the opinion in there if for some of the members here would like to see the opinion noted in there, not seeing it being redundant?
Well, could it at least say CDOS staff noted its opinion?
Fine.
I mean, otherwise it's just redundant in two parts of the sentence. It just doesn't read well.
Yeah, I think that seems to be okay with people here.
Okay, that's fine.
Great, thanks.
That'd be fine with me as well.
So CDOS staff noted that in their opinion, many of the bill's conflicts.
Great.
Insert in their opinion.
That works.
Okay.
Any other changes to this final report? Last chance. Okay, it looks like, and I just want to put out there, I appreciate the Secretary of Staff making those calls available and really, and for commissioners who were able to get on there and do some of the work so that today we can be where we are making some pretty minimal changes. So thanks, everybody, for that extra work and effort. Oh, I think, do we need Mr. Kraft for anything else? Then I don't think that we do. Appreciate the work that
okay,
you did.
Okay, I will. I'm going to save that document, basically then accept all the changes in it and forward it to Stephen. I'll remove the draft note as well.
Right. And so when would you think we'd be able to get that out to Stephen, Mr. Kraft?
It will go leave my desk in about 5 minutes.
Great. And then we'll get that. Super. And then, you know, we had a conversation last week about how this would then just be would get to the State Affairs Committee. And so I think what we're did we make that final decision that we would get this email to members of both House and Senate State Affairs Committee.
That sounds good.
So if you'd let me know how you'd like me to proceed on that, I can contact somebody over at Legislative Council to assist me with that, or I don't have the list of committee members, so I would need to get that. Maybe I can coordinate with one of the admins over there. Is that?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate the opportunity to help y'all with this, and this will go out to Stephen here just in a moment.
Thank you. So
you're welcome.
Now we're on to the business practice subgroup. So, Hillary, I don't know, are you presenting that, or is there anybody here
who's
going to join with you?
Yeah, we do. Thank you. We have Amber Reynolds, McReynolds from Denver is going to come and talk us through the chart. And A little louder. Okay. So everyone, we're reviewing the colored document that was handed out. I think there were some for audience as well. Thanks, Amber.
Good afternoon. My name is Amber McReynolds. I'm a member of the Business Practices Working Group within the Commission and also the Director of Elections in Denver. We were here last week and presented a sort of higher level overview of the business process that the counties in the state have been discussing as part of the working group. And that document was sort of presented from the voter's perspective and what the voter experience would look like at the service centers. What you're looking at today is more from the administrator's perspective, so it illustrates some of the decision points that
Steve, what are you doing?
I didn't touch anything.
Pause for a technical.
Check.
Yeah.
I think, it's okay. I turned it on now. So this illustrates some decision points that staff at the voter service centers will be engaged in while they're processing a voter in the different scenarios. Just to sort of explain some of the things that we'll see on the document, you'll see decision points, and then you'll also see references to the exception flowchart. We do not have that to present today, but that will include items such as provisionals or if someone needs assistance from an accessibility perspective or any other sort of special exceptions, if you will. So what we're going to do today is go over sort of the normal voter process, and the special exceptions will be a separate process to this. And I'll also point out through this some differences that we may see at the county level depending on voting systems or processes that may be different in each county. So first at the top, the greeter, it's envisioned that we'll have a combination or something similar form that every voter that comes to the service center would complete. And this would serve as a registration form, a replacement ballot form, and also like a signature card if the person chooses to vote in person. So the greeter would ask the voter to complete that form. They'll be directed to the computer station, and they'll be asked for the form and ID. The election judges will search for the voter in score. If the voter's found, they will determine if the voter's eligible. So they'll check and make sure that they're not a canceled voter on a felon status or on a deceased status or any other eligibility issues. If the voter's eligible, they'll write the voter ID, so the ID number that's associated, the unique identification number from SCORE that's associated with the voter, they'll write that on the form. They'll verify the SCORE address is current, so at that point they'll check and make sure that the voter hasn't moved and update if needed. Then they'll ask the voter if they would like to take home a ballot, so take a mail ballot with them off-site, vote the ballot today, a paper flat ballot in person, or vote in person on a DRE. And then the voter will do one of those three things there. So we'll go back up to the top where the question was if the voter was found when they were searched, and we'll sort of follow the no pattern. So if the voter wasn't found, the election judge will refer to the form, and on there they'll have a place where they need to state when they moved into Colorado. And if they've lived within the state for 22 days, then the voter will be registered in SCORE. If they haven't moved within the state for 22 days, they'll be referred to a provisional ballot, which will be on the special exception flowchart. So in this case, the voter would be registered in SCORE, and then we end up down at the same point. They'll be asked if they want to vote off-site using a mail ballot to take home with them, vote the ballot today in person, or vote on a DRE. So off-site, the business process side of it, the election judge will generate a ballot in SCORE. They'll print two labels. So one ballot label will be affixed to the actual form that they started to complete the process with when they were greeted. And then one label will go on the mail ballot return envelope. And that'll have a barcode. So then when it comes back, election judges will be able to barcode that in for signature verification. And then they'll give the voter the envelope and direct to either the paper or ballot on demand station, and the judge will keep the form. And this is one of those differences. So some counties are envisioning having paper ballot stock already printed at all of their service centers. Others may use a ballot on demand printer and print on demand. And also, some folks are talking about having an actual station for that to occur. And some, like I know in Denver, we sort of do everything one-stop shopping. When they're at the computer, they would get their ballot there as well and not have to go to another station. So that's sort of a point of difference there. But on here, they go to paper VOD station. And then if they're taking it off-site, the judge will take the envelope, match the label number to the ballot number, so the precinct number, make sure that that matches on the ballot style to the label. They'll give them a ballot, a secrecy sleeve, a return envelope, and an outgoing envelope, and then direct the voter to the exit because they'll be taking it with them off-site. If they are voting in person and they're voting on a paper ballot, similar process. They'll generate a ballot in score. They'll print one label and affix it to the form. So since we don't have an envelope in this circumstance, they'll only need to print one label. They'll give the voter the form and direct them to the paper VOD station. They'll be issued a ballot at that station. The judge will keep the form and match the precinct number on the label to the precinct style on the ballot. They'll hand the ballot and a larger secrecy sleeve to the voter and direct the voter to the voting booth, ballot box, and exit when they're done. If they choose to vote on a DRE, they will print, again, one label and score and affix it to the same form. The judge will retain the form, and the voter will be given a voter access card, and then they will be directed to the DRE station. And the voter access card is a programmable card that basically just tells the DRE that the correct precinct style to bring up for the voter. So once they complete voting on the DRE, they'll return their access card and exit the voter service center. So this is sort of the business process that's envisioned. And then obviously there'll be some special exceptions. So our plan, because there's quite a few special exceptions with provisionals and some of the accessibility pieces, we will create a separate workflow for that piece. So, questions?
Great, thank you. Gosh, good work. Is there any questions from the commission either here or on the phones?
Well, this is Bob Rankin. Do we have that handout online?
So Steve's going to walk his way up here. He stepped away for a minute, and we'll get that answer for you, Bob.
I can check on that. I don't know that it's been posted yet.
Yeah, that was a good explanation, but I wouldn't mind seeing the handout.
I know for sure that it was emailed to all the commissioners when I received it, so it should be at least in your email.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Tilly, did you have a comment?
I have a process. So for the next steps with this, we had talked about posting both of these for comments before adopting them, and wasn't sure how that was going to be handled, and then what we would do. I guess we would review any comments next week was my understanding of how we were going to proceed.
Right.
So
Steve, can you... is that a possibility of getting this posted with opportunity for... the general public to comment so that we could then come back and review those?
Yeah, absolutely. Any documents that the commission wants posted could be posted today.
Okay, fantastic. I think the more time
we have.
I guess
how do you solicit, just post it with soliciting comments when your meeting notices go out?
It gets posted on the commission's webpage under the date of the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So we could post this under the July 22nd meeting. And if you'd like to have an addendum, like public comment welcome or some other sort of thing, we can certainly add that text.
I guess my question is, then how does the public know they can comment on it?
Well, the first item on every agenda that we release for the commission is open public comment. So generally speaking, we've been inviting public comment from week to week.
Okay. Just specific to this then.
So,
because what would be helpful would be to have some in writing if they had it ahead of time as well. I mean, that... I guess we do public comment in different ways. I saw the meeting public comment as just general what people wanted to come and talk about, whereas this, we seemed like we were specifically soliciting comment, or maybe I'm misreading what our intent was.
I think that's right. This is Elena. I wonder, could we also send it out? It seems like there are lists that the Secretary of State's office maintains for rulemaking and other notices related to elections. Could we send it to those lists as well and say that this is something that the Commission's looking at, and if people want to comment, they can submit written comment or come to next week's meeting?
Absolutely. We maintain subscriber lists for both elections and for the Commission. And we can send whatever email the commission would like. I would ask just for a general idea of what you would like the email to say, and then we can point them online to those attachments so that we don't have to attach them to the email when they may or may not want those attachments.
Sure.
And then I'm wondering if also the County Clerks Association has any groups or lists that they think it would be important to get them out. I mean, I think what I might do for myself, since I have a Facebook page and a Twitter account, I also might put that out, and I would just recommend anyone who has that. I mean, the more that we can get that out there so we can really get good comment. But I think it's probably crucial that the Secretary of State's list, we get that out. But there are other opportunities, too.
Yeah, we can repost it to the Clerks Association site. We actually reviewed this first with the Election Statute Review Committee that is representative of the different counties to see what comments they had on that. So
and possibly maybe then
we'll just repost it and ask for any additional comments.
Or that the county clerks, maybe individual county clerks, can get it to people in their communities potentially.
So I'm seeing now, just looking online, that this document was posted on the Business Practices Subgroup page. I believe this is the same document I'm looking at here. So it has been posted.
Looks a little different.
Is it different? Yeah. Okay, I'll get the new version posted.
That was a draft that we sent out earlier.
Okay.
We'd be sending an updated version once.
Got it.
We figured out that the exceptions were more complicated and wouldn't fit on the same page. So.
Okay, so this is Martha. Do you feel like you have enough direction to get that posted?
So what I'll do is I'll post this flowchart online for the July 22nd commission meeting. And when I send out the notice and agenda, I'll add a note to the notice and agenda that public comment is being invited for the Voter Service Polling Center flowchart specifically.
That's great. Thank you.
So, and I just want to thank both the subgroup that worked really hard, and in particular Larimer County and their staff for helping drive this process. So we appreciate all the work and the next round as well. So. And the business practice group, the next meeting is scheduled in 2 weeks. So we'll have that for another meeting after that.
Great. Thank you so much. And having tried to do a flow chart for something different, it's still really complicated and difficult to be concise and then to follow all the different responses. So that this looks really fantastic and it's really helpful.
And I guess as you look at it, if you have other questions, you know, please, again, we'll be meeting in 2 weeks. If there's other questions that the commission has as they're thinking through the process, let us know and we'll bring those to the group.
Elena.
So I do have one question, and I know this came up on the last call, and I'm not sure where it landed or if it's something that'll be addressed in rulemaking. But at the top of the page, the flow chart, the part that talks about being asked for ID if required, could you talk through a little bit where you think that piece is going, because I'm very confused by it.
So we had a lengthy conversation as one of the choice points is currently in rule and law, if someone comes in for replacement mail ballot in person, it's unclear as to whether you are required to ask them for ID. Some counties consider that in-person voting, and other counties don't. And so what we spoke with the Secretary of State's office, and they're going to take it back and review it from there. And we thought we'd cover it more in depth also on the exception, but I'll give a preview of where we're headed and then take your comments on that, is that if you ask for a replacement ballot in person, that you would be required to show ID to pick up that ballot, and therefore counting that as in-person voting. The difference is if you ask for it online, we're actually mailing it to your address on your registration form, so it adds that one more check in the process. And so it seemed like it's potential for a loophole around someone who wants to vote in person and didn't actually have ID. So that's what we're looking at. With
with how in-person would look. The other piece that we were discussing, and again, it's very preliminary. That's my way of saying, like, this is what we talked about. We're not sure where it's landing. Is that if a to allow a way for a new registered voter to be ID required if they didn't have their ID with them to vote, so that they actually could be issued a mail ballot and then include their ID like other voters in that mail ballot when they returned, again, giving them that opportunity to not have to vote a provisional and still have the opportunity to be able to vote a regular ballot, showing ID like anyone who, if someone were to apply to vote for a ballot on online or through the mail, they would have that same opportunity to include ID at the with their mail ballot. So we wanted to, just because you're in person, it doesn't seem like they should have one less choice. So that was the intent of how to both keep the integrity, but also still offer that opportunity. So those are some of the exceptions that we're working with. And if you guys have comments on those or questions.
Thank you.
There are any other questions?
Okay. So then we'll have that, another, report in 2 weeks from the business practice group.
Yeah, so we meet a week from Thursday, and so that would be the, we'll look to have something for you on the, we'd like to say the 29th, but we're not sure how that, we'll shoot to have an update on the 29th, which may even be the final draft version of the exceptions portion.
Just a quick question. This is Jesse. Do you expect an answer to that or that to be resolved by then?
We've been working with Michael Haglahera from the state's office, and he was going to take that forward. So I will have an update
okay.
at that time. I don't know what that update will be.
Thank you.
Again, it's like, you know, some of the issues that sometimes when you dig deeper, there's other parts that you haven't intended. So, but we seem to, I'm not going to speak for it. We'll have an update. I'm always
thank you,
optimistic,
Hillary.
So I, you know, on that, so.
You know, one thing that we don't have on the agenda, do we need to talk about the next report or any of the applicants that coming in for the new report? Steve, can you tell us where that's at?
I believe the bid period is still running, so we don't have anything to talk about regarding that today.
Okay. Has there any, I'm assuming Kraft and Friedman were going to apply just based on the conversation we had with him, but has there anybody, any inquiries?
So that information would be with our finance department, and I don't have any updates for the commission on that.
Okay, great. Tell me the deadline again.
I believe it's Thursday. I'm not certain on that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
All right.
I realized with part of the business practice, I thought it was a separate agenda item. Did anyone, we did hand out all the SCORE advisory board documents, and I did say in my emails to you all if you had questions on those. They're pretty straightforward, but I just, at some point, would like to make that opportunity if there are any. Could be now.
Maybe. And maybe if anyone has something too that even in the next, could make any comments on that if they're not prepared today to do that.
Yeah, that's good.
The information I got from my finance department says the posting period is until July 17th at 3 p.m.
Okay. That's Wednesday then, right?
Right.
Thank you, Steve.
Trevor Timmons, our CIO for the Colorado Department of State, has made time for the commission to talk about the new security procedures that the commission had questions on last week. So if you'd like to welcome him.
We would love to. Trevor, go ahead and join us.
Hey, thank you very much again. My name is Trevor Timmons, CIO for the Secretary of State's office. So it came about because there's a section within the assessment report that Freeman Kraft McGregor put together around security practices and policies. And so and in the course of reviewing the draft, there were some questions from the commission, specifically, I think, Representative Rankin, about what security policies and practices are currently in place and where they may be going and changing, maybe under 1303. And so I prepared just a short presentation. I have two handouts. They're very small. I'll hand these one at each end of the table so you can take a look at these while I'm speaking. So there are several security policies and practices that are in place, some of which are visible to county users, some of which are not. And I've got five examples of those. The first is every regular county user of SCORE, we actually offer the opportunity for them to participate and take some online security training. It's provided by an organization called the SANS Institute. That is the Systems Administration Networking and Security Institute. It's basic security training. It's called Securing the Human. Our office has actually retained licenses, so every regular SCORE user can actually go through that training annually. And we actually track whether those individual users have actually participated in that training. And there's actually a security test at the end. Individuals can retake that test more than once, but the hope is by obtaining some basic security training, that folks will develop an awareness of internet security, basic computer security, and then they'll be better equipped to actually use a computer, such as the SCORE system in the course of their daily activities. That's one thing that we offer. In terms of the access controls on use of SCORE, historically it's been login and password. Counties actually maintain the ability to set up the users and to force password resets for folks within their county organization. And then our office actually monitors accounts that are inactive for some period of time. And that's the basic level of security that has been in place in SCORE from the beginning. The little cards that I passed around are an example of what they call multi-factor authentication. And so it's an additional level of security above and beyond just login and password, right? If you go to on Google, you can set up multi-factor authentication, ask them to send a security code to your mobile phone. If you ever actually access your Gmail account from a device that Google hasn't recognized in the past, this is the same type of technology. You not only need a login and a password, you need one of these little grid cards. And you'll notice that it's got 1 to 5 down the rows, and it's got column headings. When someone logs in to the SCORE system, they'll actually be prompted with 3 challenges. So it'll say like A2, B3, D5. And then they'll have to look on that grid and find the letter, the number that's at that intersection, and actually type it into that login screen. So if someone actually was, if their login and password was compromised, a user of SCORE, then whoever compromised that would also need one of these little grid cards to actually gain access to their account to log into SCORE. This is not something that we have in place right now. It is something we're rolling out. I believe Denver, the city and county of Denver, is one of the counties that's in the pilot training group. As we roll out this is, again, it's called multi-factor authentication. It's really trying to protect that front door into the SCORE system a little more effectively. One of the other aspects that we have is what's referred to as an acceptable use policy. It's really a written document that regular users of SCORE actually read, and then they sign to acknowledge that they understand this acceptable use policy. I anticipate that we will probably change some of the language within that policy over the next couple of years. What we have in place, we actually put together as the SCORE system was being rolled out initially, and then we've modified it, I believe, once since 2007. And again, as technology changes and time changes, I think that we'll look at that document and attempt to make sure that it's still relevant to the times, that's not overly burdensome, for someone to read and understand. But that's a standard practice, so that individuals are aware of their responsibilities in terms of using the system. And then the last thing that's pretty visible to counties right now is we asked during the initial SCORE rollout, we knew that some counties would be using voting locations, and they may desire to set up wireless communications within a vote center. And so we reached out to the individual that was then the state's chief information security officer for some guidance around setting up wireless access points. If counties chose to do so, at any early voting locations, at any vote center locations, it's relatively simple. It's a one-page document. Again, we asked the CISO for the state to review that, prior to the 2012 elections. They didn't recommend any changes. It essentially says that it must be a secured network, so it can't be like a Starbucks wireless, and that the access point has to be within the control of whoever, you know, whichever jurisdiction is actually setting up that wireless router, and the level of security is specified. It's WPA2, which is just a wireless security standard. Again, that's a single-page document. You know, a technical person who's setting up a network can easily read that and understand what those obligations are. Now, I'm not actually sure if any counties, that there's been much adoption amongst counties in terms of using wireless within vote center or in early voting sites. But again, that's the type of guidance that we do have in place today that we've provided. So those five things, those are examples of things that are pretty visible, I think, to county users. And then there's some things that are not very visible to county users in terms of security practices and policies. All of the developers within our office go through, so I mentioned that SANS Institute. They also offer secure coding practices, classes for programmers, right, that do web development or any kind of development. They're generally 3 to 5 day courses. That's a requirement in our office that programmers actually go through these SANS secure coding classes for the types of technology they're working with. We hire a firm to do human-based vulnerability tests. So it's really having a hacker sit their computer and attack one of our development systems that we use within our development practices, a human being who's actually experienced and knowledgeable in attacks, and having them try to penetrate the system, have them try to, you know, do things like SQL injection or, you know, just leverage weaknesses within the application. And that's the type of thing we do that today, although most county users may not actually realize that. We also do what is called automated vulnerability testing. Now, this is where a computer or a device is actually programmed to do automated, you know, hacking attempts. So it's not a human being sitting at a keyboard who may be very knowledgeable about particular little vulnerabilities, but it's machine-based. You don't get the same kind of coverage, really, as a really knowledgeable human being, but you do get a pretty basic level of, you know, commonly understood attacks that you'll actually, that, you know, the purpose of this automated testing is to detect those sorts of things so you can actually implement repairs to those sorts of things. We also do regular patch and vulnerability management. That's a monthly activity that takes place. We do vulnerability scans twice a month, and then generally, you know, our window for actually applying patches is in under 30 days. And we keep track of that on a regular basis. We also have intrusion detection and intrusion prevention systems. These are, they basically sit on the network, you know, on which the SCORE system resides. It actually detects nefarious looking things, you know, other computers trying to attack the system, or human beings using computers to try to attack the system. These systems are designed to detect those types of attacks and then actually automatically step in and prevent those attacks, okay? The sixth thing is geographic IP blocking. This is something where you actually detect where a remote computer appears to be located as it's trying to access SCORE, okay? Right now, we actually have that set to deter any computers that appear to be located outside of the continental United States from actually reaching the SCORE system. So if a computer appears to be in Canada or in West Germany or in China, then we actually prevent it from getting to that SCORE login page, again, just by detecting where it appears their computer's coming from. One of the other controls we have in place right now that's mostly invisible to users is today, access to SCORE is primarily through a Citrix application, with the exception of vote centers. Vote centers are actually, it's a web-based application, but it's only open for one day. So in the past, when counties were setting up vote center users, they actually have to set them up for the day on which the election is being held and the day on which that vote center is actually open. That's actually a bit of a security measure. Instead of leaving those users and their access to a vote center application up, you know, 365 days a year, we actually open it up one day for them to do testing of the connectivity of those vote centers, and then again against the production system on that one day historically that they've been, you know, using an electronic poll book from a vote center. And then the last thing that I thought worthy of note is something they call centralized log collection and monitoring. When you have a, as in the score system, you have a bunch of computers and a bunch of devices doing a bunch of different things. And for a human being, or even an automated intrusion detection system, to go try to find the logs on each of those computers to find out if there are nasty things happening, it's actually pretty onerous. And so we do something, this is pretty standard practice, but it's centralized log collection, so the logs from all of those devices end up in one spot. So a human being or a computer only needs to look in that one spot to actually try to correlate some events and try to detect if something is happening that shouldn't be happening, or to detect if someone's trying to do something that they shouldn't be allowed to do. So those are the types of things that we have in place. Again, some of those are visible to users. Some of those are not visible to users today. Some of the things that we see in the future, partly because of 1303, but generally just because the state of the art in hacking and in nasty activity out there, people trying to leverage vulnerabilities and take advantage of websites is changing every day. I mean, the risk profile changes literally almost on a daily basis. One of the most key things that we actually use within our office for core functions on our business filing systems and uniform commercial code and notary and that sort of thing is a particular type of technology they call a web application firewall. Okay, if you happen to process credit cards, you're required by the payment card industry to use a web application firewall. What it does essentially is detect patterns of usage of websites, and it will automatically block things that you haven't told it to explicitly permit, right? So normal behavior gets through, unusual behavior actually gets blocked by these devices. We think we're probably going to need to implement a WAF, a web application firewall, on the score system as we look to voter service and polling centers, because they will no longer be just basic web accessible only one day a year on election day at a vote center, but it's actually going to be open during the entire early voting period. So we think that's a technology we need to put in place. We're looking at doing some what they call web volume blocks. This is something that we do in our office. If you see a bunch of traffic from one particular computer, you have a network device that can actually step in and stop it for 20 seconds or 30 seconds. Generally, this happens when someone's testing and probing to see if they can poke a hole in your security systems. So they have these sorts of devices that actually stand up and block that activity. And typically, the way that we have this set up within, again, you know, business and UCC is if we detect a pattern like that, we'll actually step in and block it for 30 seconds. And then we open up that IP address again. If we see the same sort of activity, we block it for 24 hours. And then we open it up, and then we'll actually block it for 30 days. Now, generally, and it does happen, there are legitimate customers of our office who get blocked because they're doing funny things that we don't expect to see. Generally, they contact us, and they'll say, good grief, I'm doing a lot of searches on our website. We have programmers that wrote tools to go search through your website automatically, and for some reason now we can't even get to your website. We actually make sure there's an existing business relationship there that's necessary, and then we'll put them on an exception list. Okay, that's the type of technology we may look to implement within, you know, the score voter service and polling center technology as we roll that out. And then the last thing I wanted to mention is right now we do have occasions where we need to send personal information, private information to counties for their action, such as corrections records, death records. Counties may need to contact us about specific voter records that they have questions about, maybe because they have a question as they're trying to perform some function and the system is, there's a bug or something, and so they can't do what they're trying to do. So we encourage counties to not include personal information within the body of emails right? And so we generally have them securely transfer that file to us over a secure FTP site, okay? You know what? It works pretty well. It's highly secure. It's not easy to use. It's not very user-friendly. So we've actually done some research. We requested funding last year in our agency budget request to actually purchase and implement a secure transfer system that's actually much more user-friendly. It doesn't require an additional client, you know, a free client to be installed on a county end user's computer to transfer or receive information. And we've done a fair amount of research. We've done evaluations of three different products that are out there in the commercial space. They're mostly used by banks, you know, and that sort of thing. We will implement one of those within the next few months to actually make it easier for that private information to be transferred safely and securely, you know, between our office and county offices. Okay. So that's just kind of an overview of some of the practices that we have in place today, some of the policies that we've implemented, and then a couple, you know, kind of looking over the next hill, maybe a forecast of some of the things where we'll be making some changes over the next several months. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Well, Trevor, thank you. This is Bob Rankin. Trevor, that was a tremendous overview. I guess, you know, we're doing an awful lot of very important and good things there. I mean, and certainly beyond the scope of the commission to try to question, you know, technology at that level. I mean, there's a lot of controversy around just about everything in security these days. The one thing that continues to bother me, though, is there are 64 counties, lots of different voting centers, and really all it takes is for one of those to get hacked or compromised or, you know, service to be denied, and we're going to hit some bad publicity for it. So, you know, are we really able to do a good inventory of the capability of all of the counties and those various voting centers to really understand what you want them to do and to follow procedures? You know, is there something that we ought to recommend that's a further inventory of the county's capability to maintain a secure system?
Well, again, this is Trevor Timmons. So I would suggest that as we're moving forward and assisting counties and seeing counties' plans for implementing voter service and polling centers, that we actually work in collaboration with them to find out what level of oversight and what level of policy may be required and what level of monitoring may be appropriate as we move forward. For example, as we're implementing this multi-factor authentication system, where we require not just a login and a password, but we require the use of one of these grid cards, that's actually a gate to make sure that a county user has a login and a password, and they've actually been issued this physical card, okay? And hopefully, I know in the eyes of our office, we would want there to be a signed acceptable use policy before someone would be issued, you know, a credential to access the system. I bet we don't have a checkoff on that to ask the county to affirm that yes, we actually have a signed acceptable use policy from this individual. That's a policy we could implement to actually do that sort of thing. I think it's going to be a collaborative evolution as we're moving forward to make sure that, I mean, some of the things I've discussed here are available centrally, and they're things that we monitor and manage, okay? We do not, and I will say we cannot, go down and monitor every endpoint, every computer that is actually used by a county to access SCORE. But once it has attempted to access SCORE, we can apply some of these technologies to make sure that the usage is actually normal and that it looks and that it's permitted usage. The user's legitimate. It looks like the activities they're doing is legitimate. And I believe that Commissioner Matsumoto may have a comment or a question.
Yeah, so you provide a lot of guidance, it sounds like. But my question was really for the counties. Do they have a security policy that requires some of those things for their end users, things like security training and acceptable use?
I think it varies by county.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the next step. I guess the other thing is, these are all great security things, and it's not just House Bill 1303. I mean, we've had early voting, so it's not,
yeah,
it's not like they're suddenly new. So if there are questions or issues, they're questions or issues that we've had for some time. So along those lines, have we seen any security breaches that, I mean, I don't know of any to my knowledge, but again, that might be something that I wouldn't necessarily know.
Again, Trevor Timmons. And do we see attempts to breach the security? Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, we block IP addresses and IP subnets on a pretty regular basis, not just from SCORE, but also from other activities that are under the administration of our agency, right? So attempts to breach, yeah, we've seen that. Actual breaches, no.
Hey, Rick?
My second comment was on the newer technology to move away from secure FTP. Mm-hmm. So the one advantage to secure FTP is that it's pretty easy to write a script around it, which I've been actually doing a little bit of research to try to get corrections and CDPHE to move to a daily update. Mm-hmm. So I would just ask, or maybe we could coordinate on that offline, mm-hmm, to make sure that we're not doing something that we couldn't easily script an automated job to.
Absolutely. Again, Trevor Timmons, and I'll definitely coordinate with you. The systems that we really have two kind of major use cases that we need to satisfy. One is to make it really easy for people to send and receive encrypted emails from us that contain links to or themselves contain sensitive information. And the second piece is really being able to do some automation around the scripting of transferring files. And so we are looking at solutions that actually meet both those needs and do it in a more user-friendly manner than the system that we currently have in place.
Great.
And I'd be happy to answer any further questions. I would like to come back to something that came up maybe a month or so ago. There was a question about how many inactive, failed for reason of failure to vote records there were. I mentioned at that time that we were going to do that activity. So preserve an audit trail of those people who had been inactive, failed to vote, but actually change their status to active now, as 1303 requires. And I mentioned that we were doing that activity when we did the release of the Q2 score release to production. That did happen this prior weekend. That was completed this morning. And I've got the number of inactive failed to vote that were where the status was changed to active was 340,101. And then I'd be happy to answer any questions about either of the two topics I've spoken to today.
Hillary. This is Hillary. Is it possible, is there any written document of what you've said? Because while I understood it while you were saying it, I'm probably going to need to read it again.
I will be pleased to provide that to Mr. Ward.
Right. That would be great. Thank you.
So is there any other questions of Trevor, either on his presentation on security or on the inactive failed to vote? But I think I know for me it's going to be helpful to also see that.
And I thought we had, sorry, I guess we were jumping through it. A really quick question, sorry. Is that now available for people who are using the file? The IFTV folks have been changed and made active?
Yeah, any files that are created from this morning forward, yes.
Thanks.
Yeah.
So Hillary. Related, we had talked about having security on our meeting for the 22nd. And if we can have the document before then, I would suggest that we still continue the conversation at that point. It is, how do we match what the state's doing with the counties is one of the questions I have. And I think as a commission, that might be something we take on for recommendations of, because some counties have even stricter policies than some of what the state requires. And so it's, but I don't know if we have necessarily an inventory of where that is. And I don't know through some of the other work, Rick, you had mentioned, because we have other connections with the state, is there some way to get a look at that? I mean, a quantitative look at where people are at with their security policies, and if they're complying, you know, say with Department of Revenue, does that mean they already have those policies in place, or without creating extra work?
Yeah, I have been doing a little bit of work there, and I'll write something up prior to next week's meeting. But briefly, we talked about the CMMS system, it turns out that that's not a direct parallel, because those computers are actually issued by through a vendor, through a third-party vendor, DRC, mm-hmm. and so they control the security policies around those machines. Similarly, I had a meeting with some DMV officials, and those computers are issued through OIT, and so we maintain those machines, and we have our own security policy around what needs to be done there. The machines that you guys are using for the voter registration system are actually county-purchased machines, and so they fall under your own security policy, which I would say we do need to do an inventory just to find out who's got what kind of policy, if any, around how people are using those machines.
Anything else?
Thank you, Trevor.
So the next item on our agenda is just to set the agenda for the July 22nd, unless there's anything else that anybody has for this meeting. Jesse.
A couple of quick things. Just going back to what we were talking about with materials being posted, could it just be a policy moving forward that whatever we're going to review in this meeting, it could be posted with the agenda or whatever you put up on the announcements so that the folks in the room, the public, the commissioners on the phone, et cetera. I mean, I know you email them, but if we can just, whatever's going to be reviewed in the meeting, be posted and made public ahead of time as kind of an across-the-board policy, is that all right with everyone?
That's right, and that works to be able to do that, Steve. You don't have any?
It sure does. I should note for the record, though, that there are packets of the printed material available to the public at every commission meeting, and I've made efforts to do that as well. So
yeah, we appreciate that, and I think I may have what's helpful. I know for all of us, it's helpful to be able to review things, especially maybe someone would want to make a comment on that if it's posted. So thank you for having that available, and then if we could post those online as well.
Yeah, and I guess just as humanly possible, because I know you've got a lot ahead of time, as ahead of time as possible. And then we also referenced the listservs and distributing information that way. Is there anything that you could tell us about who gets on which listservs? Because I'm on a number of them, too, or maybe how other folks can get there.
There's a portal on our website, from what I understand, that allows members of the public to subscribe to certain elections-based lists. In addition, through the course of these meetings, certain individuals have contacted me personally, and I have added them to the distribution list for members of the general public and made sure that the materials are passed out to them as well and that they receive notices. So that's how the lists are propagated. It's a voluntary sign-on from our website.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else from anybody on the phone? Okay. So, Steve, the couple things that I have down is so we'll have security on there, which would also include the discussion around the inactive, failed to vote. And then we'll also be reviewing the bid for the selection of the vendor for the September report. And since, correct me if I'm wrong, so Thursday all the bids will be in. Well, can the commissioners get a copy of those bids on that either Friday so that we can have an ability to review them before we come on Monday's meeting?
Yeah, I'll close the loop with our finance department. All the bids are being submitted directly to our finance department. So I have to get those from them so that I can forward them to you. But I will let them know that I need to get those as soon as possible.
Okay, great. What else do we need to have on our agenda?
We have the public comment and review of the voter service and polling center flowchart.
Right. Great. Not on the 20th. Yeah, that's true.
On the 29th?
Because they won't meet prior. Anyone has anything else that we need to have on next week's agenda?
My phone's off, sorry. I don't know if this belongs on next week's agenda. This is Hillary. But
we've looked at the, we know that we have the two spelled out assessments that are in the bill itself. There's also the report that we're going to be giving in January to the legislature. And at some point, I would love to see us take a comprehensive look. What else do we need to be looking at? I know we've jumped into these because we have the right. timely deadline, and maybe that's, I don't know if we'll have time with what we need to review next week, but it might be one of those items that, if time allows, that we keep looking ahead to what else do we want to be looking at, and what else are the pieces that we need to ensure the proper implementation, both for 2013 and 2014.
Right. I think what we might do is be able to put it on the agenda, and then if we have time, I mean, if we're not bumping up against our 4 o'clock time frame, that we could have that, and then we could continue to carry it over. It might be something that would be helpful to carry over until we feel that we've kind of exhausted that.
I have a question for the commission as well. So next time we'll be looking at the proposals for the needs assessment for the equipment, and we have some outline that Al Davidson did that was great. I don't know if we've aligned on what do we want to see in that report, and would that be for next time or when we have our first conversation with the vendor, similar to what we did with Paul Kraft? I'm not sure what I'm looking for, and I don't know if we as a commission have even really put out what do we want to get out of that type of assessment. So,
this is Elena. It does seem like it'd be worth us starting to talk through that. I think we might also want Al to come back and give an update. My understanding was the last UVS meeting, a lot went on, and it might be helpful to have that perspective going into the next.
This is Bob. I'm completely missing the conversation because people, I think, moved back from the mic. What agenda item are we discussing right now?
So this is Elena. We were just talking about whether we needed to do some discussion amongst ourselves about what we'd like to see in the second report and whether it made sense to do that next week as part of our conversation or adjacent to the conversation about the bid, or if it's something we should wait until we have the consultant selected and then have that conversation with them. And then I was just adding that it seems like it'd be helpful to have Al Davidson come back because a lot happened at the UVS meeting last week, and so we might want to have that perspective as well as we think about how to approach the report.
Yeah, I would say let's do it sooner rather than later.
Great, so we'll have that on there as well. Anything else? Well, looks like we can be adjourned. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.